I didn't know that we were going to have a presentation from you this week, so we're very pleased to hear that. You contacted me earlier and said that you managed to find another flying ace that we hadn't heard of yet. So perhaps you'd like to get on with the presentation and remind us again who it is. Heinrich Heinz Bahr, is that the chap we've got for tonight?
Yes, he's called Heinz Bahr, and Heinz is basically just a shortened form of Heinrich. His full official name was Oskar Heinz Bahr, and his comrades also called him Pritzel or Reste, and his family name means bear, as in grizzly bear, again showing how closely related the German and the English languages are. He was born on the 25th of May 1913 in Sommerfeld near Leipzig. His parents were farmers, and his father was killed in action in World War I, so he had to grow up without a father. Heinz was notorious for his pranks when he was a boy. For example, when he was 12, he and some mates from school wanted to dig up some turnips on the field of a farmer so that their families might have something to eat. As we are, of course, again, talking about the Weimar period. And they were chased off the field by that farmer. Young Heinz did not think that would do, and so during the night they disassembled a hay wagon of that farmer and with the help of a pulley got the parts onto the roof of the farmer's house and reassembled the wagon there. You can imagine the astonishment of that farmer when he finally spotted the wagon he had been feverishly looking for all over the farm on the roof of his house. The feud with that farmer was not over, however, and one day he would even sic his two dogs on the turnip thieves. A counterstrike seemed necessary, and Heinz, together with his friends, took off one of the wings of a huge barn door, carried it to the village pond, put two dozen chickens on that of the farmer, and moved it to the middle of the pond, anchoring it there very firmly. The excited clucking of the chickens and the crowing of the bewildered rooster woke the farmer very early, and once he realized what had happened to his chickens, he tried to recover them using a bathtub as there was no boat available. The boys had foreseen that, though, and had drilled small holes into it. Inevitably, the farmer soon got very wet, to the delight of the boys, hiding behind some willow bushes. At school, he showed aptitude for anything related to science and technology, but at the same time, he loved everything about the forests and their wildlife. First, he intended to take over the family farm, and after regular school, went to an agricultural school. He also joined the local glider club and became a glider pilot. Then his love for the forest made him change his mind and he planned on becoming a forester. When he saw a Junkers transport plane flying, he changed his mind once more and wanted to become a pilot. He could not afford to become a civilian pilot, however, and so he could not join the Deutsche Lufthansa as he had intended. Instead, he joined the Reichswehr in 1934, working as a mechanic for the 4th Motor Vehicle Battalion, and the following year he was accepted into the Luftwaffe. First, he flew transport planes, having earned a license for flying multi-engined aircraft, but then he transferred to the fighter wing, where he trained on the Bf 109. He was of stocky build, muscular and tough. His appearance and character seemed to be very fitting for his family name. He was by all accounts pleasant to be around and not easily roused to anger, but if someone did become too offensive towards him, he would fight back, verbally at first, which usually did the trick, as he was good with words, quick-witted, and would often leave his opponent speechless after hitting him with some bitingly sarcastic remark, or otherwise, figuratively speaking of course, hit him over the head. If that was not enough, he was not afraid to use his fists either, if necessary. Soon it turned into a proverb, almost, and became his motto: where the bear hits, grass will grow no more. Many enemies would later learn just how true that was. At the start of the war, Baer was serving with Jagdgeschwader 51, which had been created virtually out of nothing by Theo Osterkamp. We have heard of Osterkamp when we talked about Adolf Galland a few months ago. When he received the order to lead the 51, it existed only on paper. On the 25th of September 1939, Baer was on duty at the border with France, guarding against intruding enemy planes. He was flying in his BF-109E when he spotted a French Morane. Baer approached it on a frontal collision course, showing nerves of steel. About 200 meters in front of him, the French pilot pulled up his fighter, and Baer fired, scoring several hits on the enemy plane, which started to emit smoke. Not long after that, he was behind the French plane, another burst from his weapons tore up the left wing of the Morane, which then started to descend like a leaf in the wind, uncontrollable. Baer saw no parachute, and the plane impacted on the ground, turning into a ball of fire. "Well done, Baer. That was your first," he heard a comrade calling to him over the radio. Back on the ground, he was first told off because he had left the formation on his own initiative, but then he was also congratulated by the group commander. "At least you got him. Congratulations." On the 29th, he received the Iron Cross Second Class. This early in the war, it was much easier to come by these decorations than in later years. Early in the morning of the 10th of May 1940, the beginning of the actual France campaign, the first group of Jagdgeschwader 51 was attacking the airport of Rotterdam, and Baer was with them. After Dunkirk, Colonel Osterkamp drove to the coast near Wissant to establish an airbase there. But when he returned, a squadron of Spitfires had just attacked. Their course had been tracked, however, and Osterkamp ordered all available fighters to counterattack the airfield from which the Spitfires had taken off. They had to be refueling and rearming, he reckoned. Osterkamp's order was in fact to attack the airfield and land if possible at all. Baer was with the attackers, and also Josef Priller, another famous Knight's Cross holder, who was reputed for his excellent eyes, and it was he who spotted the hidden airfield. Priller shot down a Spitfire that hadn't landed yet, and then they strafed the airfield, setting the staff building and several airplanes on fire. 10 Spitfires were burning, and also 4 French Breguet and a Potez. They landed and took several prisoners. The ground personnel had already been evacuated, and the attack on the 51's airbase was supposed to be the last mission before withdrawing to Bordeaux. On the morning of the 13th of June, Baer took part in an attack on the airbases around Paris, escorting Stukas and Heikel 111, but also himself shooting up reconnaissance and fighter aircraft still on the ground. On their way back, they were attacked by a squadron of French fighters who fought with tenacity. They managed to shoot down 8 German bombers and 5 fighters, but lost 22 fighters themselves. Baer was made Schwarmleader, meaning he was in command of a Schwarm, which consisted of 4 fighters. And now the time of the Battle of Britain was at hand. Theo Osterkamp was promoted to Generalmajor, and Werner Mölders was given command of Jagdgeschwader 51. Mölders was the leading German expert at the time and was the first pilot to receive the Knight's Cross. One day, as he was flying over England with his Schwarm, they were attacked by 9 Spitfires. "Watch out, Pritzl, behind you," he was warned by his wingman. Baer pulled his fighter up into a turn and looked back to see his opponent not able to follow his maneuver. He completed his turn and got into position behind the Spitfire. His machine guns and cannons lit up the Spitfire, and Baer followed it, a mistake which also nearly cost Adolf Galland his life one time, because the other 8 Spitfires were all on his tail. Here's now what happened next in the words of Heinz Baer, as reported later by Baer's first mechanic. Quote, I saw in the rearview mirror how suddenly the whole bunch of opponents was breathing down my neck. Tracer bullets were whistling by to the left and right of my crate. Then the fuselage was hit. Those darned English were using me as target practice. More bullets hitting the fuselage among terrific noise. The right wing was turned into a sieve, and the left one didn't look much better. Why those darned fellows were shooting up my wings and not the cockpit, I didn't know. I don't know. But one Spitfire after the other tried its luck, and I was weaving this way and that to escape all these salvos. End quote. I'll have to add here that I didn't do justice to the humorous style of Bear. It's really hard to translate to English. Bear was only 2 dozen meters off above the sea, racing eastward, when suddenly a Spitfire appeared on his right flank and opened fire. The glass covering his instrument panel shattered. His engine started to shudder and finally stood still. All he could do was to make the impact as smooth as possible. He was quite successful, and immediately he threw off the canopy and climbed out. His life jacket inflated as he pulled the string. Even though it was summer, the water was ice cold. As he was swimming away from the airplane, he turned around and he saw the tail section still sticking out of the water and then going under. Fortunately, he was spotted by a Heinkel 59, a biplane which can be equipped with floats. Of the just recently established Sea Rescue Command Cherbourg. And in the evening, he was back with his comrades and welcomed with cheers. Bear had to tell the group commander what he experienced, and when he mentioned the cold water, his superior said, as far as I know, there are 2 currents in the channel, one warm and one cold. Then I must have fallen into the cold one, Herr Major, he replied laconically. Somewhat later, after he had been shot down 2 more times over the channel, he commented, for some reason, I always seem to fall into the cold one. One time over the channel, Bear saw his wingman taking fire from a Spitfire. A big hole was already gaping in his vertical stabilizer, and the Spitfire was about to do more damage as Bear swooped down on him and his bullets hit their mark. The Spitfire was trailing smoke. But as the Spitfire simply flew on a steady course, and no parachute could be seen, Bear approached it, and when he was close enough, he could see the British pilot pointing at his blood-soaked pilot suit and then pointing to his leg, indicating that he was also wounded there. There seemed to be no way that he could parachute from his fighter. Bear signaled to the British pilot that he should turn around and fly east. Fortunately, the engine damage doesn't seem to have been severe, as the smoke soon subsided, and Bear and his wingmen guided the Spitfire to Calais, where it landed safely. Over the radio, they had already called for an ambulance. The British pilot, who turned out to be a captain, shook Bear's hand, and Bear then had his first mechanic bring a bottle of cognac, which he gave to the captain to help ease his recovery. After the 6th air victory, Bear received the Iron Cross first class on the 6th of July, 1940. And now let's hear what Werner Möllers had to say about Bear. Quote, this young pilot has something which can make him into one of the best. He is a fighter, a daredevil, without selling his skin too cheaply. He has the eye and the flying abilities required for a true fighter pilot. End quote. And this is what Bear in later years had to say about Mulders, who was called Fati or Daddy by the pilots because as their superior, he always had an open ear for them. Quote, he was a fellow you could touch, a role model concerning education and bravery. He did not only become my revered mentor. Everybody was striving to be like him. That is what he was about, caring for us like a father would and passing on to us all that we still needed to learn to become good fighter pilots like him. And on these bright notes, I will end part one. Next week, we are going to find out that he did not only serve in France and during the Battle of Britain, but was fighting on more or less all the fronts of the war.
Well, thanks, Schmidt. That was really enlightening. I mean, they're really, really honourable people, aren't they? These people that were fighting in the war. You think he went there to help the British, to help to rescue that British fighter pilot and then shared cognac with him? That's not the sort of behaviour that you see happening nowadays, but back then they were really honourable. And I think you can see that from the innocent pranks that he was playing when he was a boy. And you think of all the thought that went into playing these jokes on the farmer after they'd been stealing the turnips from him, rebuilding something on the roof of the shed and, thinking ahead to drill holes in the bath so that when the farmer went back out on the pond to rescue his chickens, the bath sank underneath there. And that shows really forward thinking and ingenuity and, sort of something quite funny, playing a joke. You just wouldn't really see that nowadays with young people today. They wouldn't play a joke like that, and the farmers wouldn't expect to have a joke like that played on them. But when you've got a community, when you've got people that are all the same race, the same nation, the same language, with the same sense of humour, then you can do things like that. And that's a really interesting tale there. I look forward to hearing more. I know that he's reckoned as one of the best flying aces. He's certainly in the top 10 with quite an incredible number of downed aeroplanes from the enemy. And also, you've got to mention there of Galland, who you've also done one of your Axis War Heroes presentations on. So it just shows you how they're all linked up together and all fighting in the same war. It's I enjoyed that. Dennis, have you got any comments you'd like to make on that?
Well, I'm a chicken when it comes to flying, you know that. When he says that he's skimming over the sea with a Spitfire coming closing in on him, it's the last place on earth I'd want to be, really. Will. I mean, I can't admire these guys any more than I do. Tremendous courage and, as you say, honour. Tremendous ability as well, and just... just incredible courage.
I'm not sure, it also makes me think that it must have been much cheaper to learn to fly back then, because you've got a farmer there that was getting gliding lessons and learning to fly a glider. Now, I'm not sure, whether someone of the status of a farmer or someone who worked on a farm would be able to afford to do anything like that nowadays. Must have been cheaper back then, I would have thought.
Well, I think it was sponsored by the National Socialist Government, these glider clubs. Yeah. So it wasn't they didn't have to pay as much as would have been necessary if they had to pay the market price, so to speak.
So because he'd already shown talent and aptitude at doing that, they were prepared to help fund the cost, that sort of thing?
Yes, that is my understanding.
Yeah, sorry, Dennis, you were saying something then. I think might have talked over you.
Yeah, what I was saying was, they still had the pilots from World War One, obviously, but I mean, they were banned from having an air force at all, weren't they, during the Weimar? So there wouldn't have been that many up-and-coming pilots, I mean, I thought. So it would have been interesting for the National Socialists to actually fund and cut price to get some pilots up to speed, I would imagine.
Well, it was a glider as well that they were using rather than an aeroplane.
So last week we talked about Baer's youth, his entry into the Luftwaffe and his first air victories in the France campaign. For his sixth air victory, he had received the Iron Cross First Class. I quoted Werner Mölders, who was arguably the most competent fighter pilot of the day, as saying that he saw a lot of promise in Baer, and that he did have the right stuff to become a most outstanding fighter pilot. And now for the continuation of his story. Baer had achieved 20 air victories in the West when he was sent east with Jagdgeschwader 51, which was commanded by Mölders, for Operation Barbarossa, the Russia campaign. Baer was there from day one. On the 22nd of June, Baer and his wingman, Oberfeldwebel Heinrich Höfemeier, were escorting a damaged Heinkel 111 back to the German lines when they spotted 18 Soviet Tupolev SB bombers. Those are twin-engined and rather fast. They have two machine guns in the nose and one machine gun for defense, each in the dorsal and ventral positions. They both attacked with Bär shooting down two and Höfemeyer even four Tupolevs, but Höfemeyer was wounded in the arm in the process by defensive fire. More 109s joined the hunt, and in the end, not a single Soviet bomber made it back home. By the end of June, so just a few days after the beginning of the campaign, he had added seven more air victories, including the two bombers, to his tally. And on the 2nd of July, he received the Knight's Cross for all his combined achievements in the war up to that point. Bär was really on a roll now. Until the 14th of August, he had shot down a further 33 Soviet fighters and bombers, bringing his total to 60. When he came back to his airfield on the 10th of August, he had to fly over twice so he could wag his wings, which was the German way of announcing an air victory, if you remember. And he had to wag them five times for these five victories. His friends and comrades couldn't believe their eyes, and shouts of joy and appreciation erupted spontaneously. For the number of 60 defeated enemies, he was awarded the oak leaves to the Knight's Cross. Even a little before that, he had been appointed squadron leader, so he was in charge now of approximately 12 BF-109s. He took on a habit of virtually always facing the enemy first and returning to the airfield as the last one of the squadron. As he said once, he did this because even in aerial warfare, the old saying applies that the last one gets bitten by the dogs. In other words, he alternated between acting as vanguard and rear guard. In September 1941, two BF-110s on patrol spotted a large group of Soviet airplanes. They relayed that information, and Bär and his men scrambled to their 109s and took off to intercept them. They flew in the direction of where they suspected the enemy formations to be presently, and were shot at by Soviet flak when they flew over the front line. Fortunately, it was only light flak and could not reach them at their altitude. Then they spotted them, a very large formation of heavy bombers escorted by about 20 fighters, and in front of them a squadron of IL-2 ground attack bombers. Bär gave the order to attack the bombers while he was maneuvering to get his airplane into a position so he could attack the bombers, or fat cars, as Luftwaffe pilots usually called them in colloquial language, coming from the sun. The reason for that, of course, is that it is much harder to track and aim for an object that has the blinding sun behind it. One of the bombers was now in his crosshairs, and he fired both the machine guns and the cannon. A couple of dozen projectiles hammered into the bomber, and a jet of flame burst out. A few seconds later, it started to go down in flames. Three or four of the bombers found a similar fate at the hands of his comrades. The Soviet fighter escort was now upon them, but Bär insisted to keep pressing the attack on the bombers. He took aim at another bomber, and that one also burst into flames. But now he was under fire from the Soviet fighters, and he pulled up, performing a tight turn at the same time. Soon after, he was diving down onto one of the enemy fighters, and with a single burst of his weapons, sent it spiraling towards the ground. He could not have his eyes everywhere, however, and so he was hit several times. One burst took off the tip of his right wing, and then something quite unusual happened. One of the IL-2 ground attack planes started to come after him. Normally, that would not be that much of a problem, but since his 109 was damaged, it turned out to be quite hard work to defeat that enemy. The IL-2 is not very good at performing tight turns, but in this particular situation, his 109 crippled was more than a match. The IL-2 does have a devastating firepower, and for a few minutes all that Bär could do was stay out of its line of fire. Finally, he managed to climb above the enemy plane, and just before diving past it, fired his weapons, causing the IL-2, or Sturmovik as it is also known, to explode mid-air, its debris falling, scattering over a wide area. Just as he was turning to limp back home to his airfield, he was attacked by two more Soviet fighters coming in from above. He heard and felt the impacts of the bullets, heard glass splinter, and his front window was smeared with oil. His engine had also been hit. He knew he was still over Soviet-controlled territory, but he had to get out, and so he did. His parachute opened, and while he was still hanging in the air, he saw his 109 crash and burn. As soon as he hit the ground, he went on his way, but not westward, as he suspected the Soviets would expect him to do just that. Instead, he turned towards the south. He walked or jogged through bushes and small patches of forest, avoiding any farmhouse or village he came across. According to his reckoning, he was about 40 kilometers from the German lines. He did have a pistol and emergency rations with him, but not nearly enough food to keep it, up his strength for the whole journey, as he could not just simply walk in a straight line. He knew he would be recognizable as a German simply from his appearance, so he messed up his hair, put some hay into it, and generally tried to look like a Ukrainian or Russian farmer. He smeared his leather jacket with mud, stuffed it with hay, and tied it into something like a makeshift rucksack. His incriminating belongings he put into it, including his knight's cross with the oak leaves and also his pilot boots. So he was walking barefoot after that. After he got on his way again in his disguise, he was spotted by some Ukrainian farmer girls digging up potatoes. They called to him, but he just waved to them. He did his best to avoid further encounters. He often heard engine and tank noises. The enemy was too close for comfort. Eventually, he became so hungry that he dug up some potatoes himself and ate them raw. They tasted terrible, but helped to quench his thirst somewhat, at least. When he finally came close to where he suspected the German front lines to be, he put on his jacket again and kept his pistol at the ready. His feet were in a terrible state by this time, as he was walking with bare feet, sometimes over harvested wheat fields and the like. After night had fallen, he proceeded to the last part of his journey. He saw a Soviet guard post and yet decided to just keep walking straight towards his goal. He was spotted and a Soviet called to him. Bear replied with a curse or some cussing in Russian, making the best use of the few words of that language he knew. Oddly enough, this only provoked laughter from the Soviet guard, and Bear kept on walking. I'm guessing that not in his wildest dreams would he have thought a German soldier would pass him, walking fully erect and cussing at him in Russian, going back to the German lines. The last 200 meters, however, he was crawling on the ground, passing Soviet machine gun nests. Finally, he heard someone calling to him in German, asking for the watchword of the day to make sure he was not an enemy. Bear replied in his Saxon accent, which cannot be possibly be rendered in English, unfortunately. But I'm sure most German speakers would chuckle simply because of the way he said what he did. So, translated, he replied, "Don't you try to be funny with me. I am Oberleutnant Bear of Jagdgeschwader 51's 1st Group, and with bare feet I walked 40 kilometers." The word he used wasn't actually walked, but in its stead a German slang word for walking with a humorous connotation. In any case, for the German soldiers, hearing the Saxon accent was almost as good as the correct watchword, and they let him approach. And when they saw his knight's cross, they were certain that he was indeed Heinz Bär. They had heard he had been shot down. Bär only had one request, which was readily granted, to be given some strong coffee and some bread and sausage. He had been eating nothing but raw potatoes and had been drinking out of puddles, as he put it. Wow. It was great.
Well, I was just going to say, potatoes, aren't they poisonous? I always thought eating raw potatoes was poisonous.
Yes, it is. I haven't researched this, but from what I know, there's a poison, I think it's called solanin, and it can make you sick. I don't think it's, I think you would have to eat kilograms of potatoes to really put your life in danger, but I'm guessing he got some, maybe some stomach cramps or something from it.
No, I mean, that's a real hardship. Barefoot as well. Walking barefoot for 40 miles after crashing the plane, jumping out in a parachute. And this is, you know, I mean, he's really made of some strong stuff, isn't he? Really courageous and got real stamina to be doing that. Can you imagine not being able to see as well? He's got oil all across the, you know, all across the cockpit screen. So he's thinking, well, what am I going to do? Am I going to jump out? Do I keep going? You know, it's just shocking. There's the sort of things that they actually went through, and the incredible luck he must have had to actually get past, you know, get past all the Ukrainians, get past the Russians, not get shot at, make his way past through the guards, through the sentry guards, and make his way back to the home turf. I mean, there's definitely somebody watching over him, I would say.
I would agree with you on that. And also, it's amazing to me that he kept this cool head. He did not go straight for the German lines, but went on a detour to sort of throw off his pursuers. I don't think just anyone would think of that in that situation.
Well, you would think, you know, I mean, the temptation would be to go to one of the Ukrainian peasants and ask them for help. But obviously, he couldn't trust them, I guess. That's what you would instinctively try and do, wouldn't you? Because you think, well, the Russians are attacking the Ukrainians, they're going to be sympathetic to us. I guess at the same time, he'd be thinking that the Ukrainians would be, they wouldn't want to risk their lives by helping him. So you just have to keep out the way and hope that nobody recognized him.
I think it would be like playing Russian roulette, no pun intended. But he could very well have met friendly Ukrainians, or he could just as well have met some that had been, infected by the communist ideology, so to say.
And the temptation as well may have been to get rid of his Iron Cross, because that would have identified him as the enemy if he was trying to sneak through Ukraine, through the Russians. He didn't want to be identified. I mean, that's pretty brave of him to keep that on him, to keep all the information on him that shows who he is. Because if he had have been caught, they would have known straight away that he was German. They would have known that he had been firing on the Russians as well. And yet he kept hold of that. That was more important to him.
From a purely safety point of view, it was probably not the best decision, in a way, but I think he would have considered it something dishonorable to throw away his decoration. I think just like probably all the German soldiers, he held them in great esteem, these decorations.
It just shows you how much value they placed in honor, in doing the right thing. It's all about honor and loyalty. Your word is your honor. Please go. Please continue.
Okay. Where was I?
He just managed to get through into the German lines, and he just asked for some coffee. I was surprised at that as well. I would have thought that he would have asked for some brandy or some cognac or a stiff drink to wake him up. But he asked for coffee. Was it?
Yes, I don't know about his personal habits in this respect, but there were all kinds of German pilots. Hans Ulrich Rudel was famous for drinking only mineral water and milk. It had actually become like sort of a saying among the front soldiers that he only drinks that. But then there were, of course, those that really liked the alcoholic drinks.
Because didn't he last week, when he rescued that other pilot, he offered him a brandy straight away, didn't he?
Yes, cognac it was, yes.
So you would think that That was the established thing, was to offer someone a drink after they'd had a, you know, had a hard time and had to bail out from the plane or and what have you. I'm just surprised that he didn't actually ask for a drink there. I guess he wanted to keep his wits about him.
Maybe his concern or his motivation at that point was simply to get something that would give him back some strength, because one can easily imagine that he must have been dead tired after this ordeal. So coffee was perhaps the thing at the front of his mind at that point.
Yeah, just the adrenaline and his courage that keeping him going, I would have thought, if that's all he'd been eating was these raw potatoes. Incredible.
Yes. So there was great joy among Bear's comrades when they heard he was alive. And after Bear had recovered somewhat, he was back in action and shot down just about every type of aircraft the Soviet Air Force was employing. After his 80th air victory, he was sent back home to the fatherland for his first real rest from the war. He was also promoted to Hauptmann, that is a captain. And then after his return to the front, he soon was up to 90 air victories. And on the 12th of February 1942, he was mentioned in the Wehrmacht Bericht. That was the first of three times he was mentioned. 4 days later, he was awarded the Swords to the Knight's Cross and was ordered back to Germany again to receive the decoration from Adolf Hitler in person. Bär was the seventh German soldier to receive the swords. After his return, he was appointed group commander of the first group of Jagdgeschwader 77 and therefore had to leave his former comrades from the 51 behind. Bär did not like that. He requested to be able to stay with the 51, but a final order from Göring made the transfer inevitable. He was ordered to stay grounded and not put himself into further danger, but regular listeners probably know what followed. He defied that order and kept taking to the air whenever possible. On the 19th of May 1942, Bär scored his 100th air victory as the 9th Luftwaffe pilot to achieve that mark. In June of the same year, the 77 was moved to the Mediterranean theater of war. They were involved in the air battles over Malta and later in the North African campaign. As group commander, Bär was responsible for a lot of administration, but as he would rather fly, just like Adolf Galland, with whom he became close friends in later years, by the way, he delegated most of that work to his adjutant. Bär and Galland were similar in more than one, more than that aspect. Of both, it could be said that they had a discipline problem, or that they were simply very strong personalities, depending on one's point of view. This got Bär into trouble with Hermann Göring, again, just like Galland. At one point, Göring even stripped him of his command and downgraded him to squadron leader. But it would not last, as his qualities were too evident and he was needed as a group leader. But when Bär was suggested for the Diamonds to the Knight's Cross several times by his superiors, Göring ignored these recommendations, and for that reason he never awarded them. Or he was never awarded them. Even though he was now fighting in the British and later the Americans in Africa, Bär kept increasing his score. On the 5th of March 1943, Bär was attacked by 8 Spitfires simultaneously, and he was alone. He shot down one of them, and the others retreated. I'm guessing they were running out of fuel. 2 days later, he achieved his 170th air victory. On the 26th of March, Bär was again alone and up against 8 Spitfires, but this time with the roles reversed. He was the aggressor and again shot down one of them. 2 days after that, there was a small celebration when Bär was promoted to major. During that time, Bär was in the air and observed several 109s chasing two American P-40s. They simply couldn't hit them, even though they were trying hard. Bär looked on for a while, but he was getting increasingly angry. When he couldn't take it anymore, he yelled over the radio, "Let me have a go, you idiots." he actually literally said, "You stupid dogs," an expression not usually in use in English, as far as I know. In any case, the pursuing 109s disengaged and Baird doffed down on the two P-40s, shooting the first into flames, and then about a minute later, the second one exploded. After they had all landed, the humbled young pilots asked Baird how he does it. Baird's somewhat laconic reply was this: "You fellows go at it like Blücher," a reference to the Prussian general of the Napoleonic Wars. "But you are missing something important. You have to instinctively do the right thing and do it at the right time." That was quite a cryptic reply, but I'm guessing the point was that you can't simply put years of experience and perhaps also talent into a few sentences for the students to emulate.
It's all about timing, isn't it? It's all about timing. You know, life is all about getting the right timing. If you do something at the wrong point, then it's going to fail, it's going to fall flat. And if you get it just at the right point, it's going to succeed, and you'll be the hero of the day. I think this was true for a lot of the National Socialists. It's definitely true for Hitler. He talked so much about providence, and providence is all about recognizing what providence is showing you and seizing that chance when you're given it, because you may not get that chance again. And I think that's, you know, that's what he was talking about there, is doing things at the right time. You see your chance and you seize it. You don't wait and think, well, I'll wait for the chance to happen again. You've got to do things when life presents you the opportunity. And he was obviously transferring that to his battle skills, and that's because that's of what had got him to where he was at that time, because he obviously had a discipline problem. So it wasn't from obeying orders that he got to where he did. He got to where he did by seizing the chances when they were presented to him, I think.
Yes, I would agree with that also. And another aspect would perhaps be that he also tried to tell him that they should listen to their gut feelings, to their instincts, and not always completely rely on the intellectual mind in air combat. I think it's also very important to have a situational awareness, so that you know when the right time to attack is and when the right time to make a retreat is.
Because you can study as much as you like about theory, but when you're actually putting something into practice, all of that can go out the window. So again, where he was referring to doing it at the right time, he's referring to his experience, and he can't teach all that experience to people. They have to actually experience it themselves before they're going to be able to do something like, I mean, what did you say, 170? Is that 170 or was that 117? Planes that he shot out of the sky by that time?
I think it was, a few days after that it was, or no, his total in Africa was 179.
Wow.
And it was around 170 in any case.
That's incredible. And going on gut instinct, you know, I think instinct and intuition is really important. I mean, not obviously in dogfighting, I'm not a pilot, but intuition, what you feel about people when you first meet them is really important. Intuition counts for a lot. And we forget what our intuition tells us, because all the programming we receive telling us that diversity is a strength and all the races are equal, we lose our intuition. We learn to ignore our intuition. And yet, if people listen to their intuition, there wouldn't be half as many rapes and attacks that go on, interracial rape and interracial attacks, because your intuition and your instincts tell you that these other races, you shouldn't be trusting them. But we ignore our intuition because we think it's bad to be like that. We think we're being bad people if we try to avoid these other races. And because we think we're going to be bad if we avoid them, these women deliberately go out and be friendly to them, and then they end up being raped. And it's all because of ignoring intuition. Which is something that I've learned, is that I should pay attention to my intuition. And I think everyone should pay more attention to their intuition and less attention everything that they read about things, because your gut instincts are there for a reason. Your gut is, they used to say that was where the seat of your soul was. It was in your gut. It was your bowels. They didn't used to say in your heart like they do today. It was in your bowels, in your gut. It was what you felt there, the gut instinct. That was the truth. That was, you know, God speaking to you. And I'm sure that's what helped Hitler with his decisions, was his gut instinct, following providence and his intuition, which led him to doing the right things and saying the right things. It's far more important than studying. I don't think Hitler studied to learn what to say. It all came straight from the heart, didn't it? He stood up there and he spoke his speeches. He didn't have lines in front of him. He didn't have notes in front of him. He didn't have an auto cue like the people use today. It all came straight from the heart. It was all his spirit and his intuition to say the right thing and inspire the masses to get behind him and make the changes that Germany needed, and to inspire the people to go out there and fight, like Heinz Baer. And that's an incredible amount of planes to have shot down, 170. Anyway, I keep interrupting you, Schmidt. I know we want to make this presentation a little bit more conversational than usual, but I'll pass it back to you.
Yes, and maybe we can return to this very subject after the presentation. Something came to my mind when you were speaking, but yeah, maybe we should not make a complete gap here and interrupt the presentation for too long. So should I go on?
Yes, please do.
All right. So Baer had achieved 68 more air victories in Africa, bringing his total to 179, as I mentioned before. And now followed the clash with Göring, as I also mentioned before. And because he talked back to Göring, he was stripped of his rank and responsibilities for quote-unquote insubordination. The defense of the Reich was from now on Baer's task until the end of the war. By March 1944, Baer had his rank back and was generally rehabilitated and in command of the second group of Jagdgeschwader 1. He was now flying the Focke Wulf 190 A7. Baer's arrival boosted the morale of the group, and that was desperately needed, as the pilots were often powerless to stop the terror bombing of German civilians. On the 22nd of April, Baer scored his 200th air victory. That was an American B-24. To give you a rough idea of what these men were up against, on the 2nd of November 1944, 384 heavy 4-inch bombers were flying towards the German cities, and they were escorted by a staggering 600 P-51 Mustang fighters. On January the 1st of 1945, the Luftwaffe launched a desperate attempt to destroy a lot of the Western Allies' airplanes on the ground by attacking air bases in Holland and Belgium. This was called Operation, or in German, Operation Bodenplatte. That would be roughly ground plate in English. They did have considerable success, and Heinz Baer was with them, scoring several destroyed aircraft on the ground. But the several hundreds of aircraft that were destroyed were very soon replaced by the British and Americans. I actually read that within 2 weeks those losses had been replaced, which tells us something about the absolutely enormous industrial capacity of the United States. And at the same time, the Luftwaffe had lost even more of its experienced pilots. Baer's personal success in Operation Bodenplatte, he was again suggested for the diamonds to the Knight's Cross, but Göring again ignored it. Towards the end, Baer was flying the Messerschmitt 262, the world's first operational jet fighter. He was now serving with the Jagdverband 44, which was led by Adolf Galland. And this was a sort of collection of the very best pilots that were still alive. just like he didn't have any apparent problems changing from the BF-109 to the Focke-Wulf 190, he took to flying the jet very quickly, and Galland commented to Bear that he was better in it than himself, to which Bear replied, "That may be, because I learned from you." Bear shot down 16 opponents in the 262, both fighters and bombers, more than anyone else. As Galland had been wounded, Bear took over command of Jagdverband 44, and on the 4th of May 1945, he ordered the last remaining 262s to be destroyed, and he led his men into captivity, surrendering to the US-American forces. After he was released, he settled in Braunschweig. He could not return to his native Saxony because it was occupied by the Soviets, or rather, he did not want to. He found work with an aircraft manufacturer as a test pilot. One day he died doing what he loved best, flying. It was the 28th of April 1957 when he put an airplane he was test flying into a flat spin, but for whatever reason he could not recover it from that spin, and his LF-1 Zaunkönig crashed into the ground, killing him instantly. During the war, he had flown over 1,000 combat missions. His 220 confirmed air victories put him at the rank of 8th on the list of the most successful fighter pilots of all times. Only Hans-Joachim Machsey had more victories against the Western Allies. He shot down 21 American heavy bombers, and thus saving the lives of perhaps hundreds of civilians in the process. Another most remarkable man, in my humble opinion.
Quite incredible there, and very sad to think that he died in peacetime. He'd flown so many sorties against the enemy, over 1,000, killed hundreds of them, taken out hundreds of other planes that were firing at him, bailed out in his parachute, and yet when he's flying a plane in peacetime, he ends up crashing and dying. It seems when your time is up, your time is up. And if your time isn't yet up, then you're going to be safe. It seems to me as if we're all fated. We've got a certain amount of time, we've got a certain destiny, and when that's up, it's up. But until that time, you're quite safe. I mean, that's incredible to think that all those right the way through the war, he was fighting, and yet in something which he should have been, completely safe on. It should have been as easy to him as riding a bike, and yet he ends up crashing. It's a shame he didn't get on with Goering. I think maybe that was because he was seeing Goering as an equal instead of as a superior. If Goering thought that he was insubordinate to him, wasn't following orders, I would suggest that was because he was talking back to him, just seeing him as an equal. Because he seems like the sort of person that saw everybody as equal to him, even if they were officers, even if they were higher than him. And I think Goering was the type that liked to pull rank. He was quite aristocratic, wasn't he? He was from aristocratic class, I think Goering was. So when he sees somebody that's not from aristocratic class, that's flying these planes, that is talking back to him or talking to him as if he's on the same level, he's not going to like it. It's a shame, because he obviously got on well with Galland, and that was with Galland being the superior officer. So, maybe he would have got even more medals, and maybe it would have been even more highly decorated if it hadn't been for Goering.
Yes, that seems certain. As I mentioned, he was recommended several times for the diamonds to the Knight's Cross, and I think that this was the only time this ever happened, that someone who was recommended three times for it did not get the award. So Goering really seems to have had a dislike for him. Probably because of the perceived or actual insubordination. And he was very similar in that respect to Galland. I mean, Bear was similar to Galland, because Galland would also just talk back to Goering when he thought Goering was not right with what he was saying. And you, also when he perceived some injustice, Göring had a tendency to accuse Luftwaffe pilots of not performing at their best. But personally, I think that that is a completely wrong assessment. I mean, I think nobody could say the German pilots didn't fight hard enough.
Did Göring?
Maybe it was.
Did Göring ever actually go up in any of the planes at all, or was he just on an armchair general?
Well, he was a World War I fighter ace, so you can't say that Göring didn't know what he was talking about. Well, maybe you could say that he had an old-fashioned and a sort of a perception of aerial warfare that was outdated, that you could perhaps say that. But he certainly wasn't simply an armchair general that had no combat experience. He was actually quite highly decorated in World War I.
That the technology would have moved forwards. And you were talking about the Messerschmitt there and the first jets that they're using. And it's quite different from World War I, where you're using propellers and the plane is sort of held together with string and balsa wood. Quite a change just in the years in between the two wars. There was a massive move forward in technology, especially in Germany. If you think back to what they had in World War One, what they were flying around in, those biplanes, and you compare that to a jet engine, you're going to be thinking about different techniques, different tactics that you're going to be using. And maybe Göring was still sort of stuck in the past, as well as being a little bit snooty, I think. I'd like to read Göring's autobiography. David Irving has done a really good one of him, apparently. It's a huge book. I have to read that. Have you read that at all, Schmidt?
No, not yet, but it's on my list. But I have a lot of a lot on that list.
A lot on the list. Yeah, and another thing I was thinking when he was going after the grounded planes before they'd taken off, was that around the time of the firebombing of the German cities that they were doing that to try and stop some of that happening?
Yes, exactly. It was on the 1st of January that that last massive Luftwaffe attack on the air bases that had previously been under German control, and then by that time were under the control of the Western Allies. And they had their airplanes parked there, and actually they were being quite careless. They had them parked in row after row in the open and were easy targets. They actually didn't expect the Luftwaffe to go in for another strong assault.
Why was that then? Why weren't they expecting that? Did they think that they would be safe with them on the ground and not in the air? Or did they think it was an honourable thing not to attack them when they were on the ground? Or what? What were the reasoning for that, do you think?
No, I think it's quite clear in this case, because Galland was in charge of the airplane administration. And he had carefully gathered up or saved airplanes. He didn't put all of them into action. He had pilots trained for, actually not for this occasion, because Galland, his idea was to save up airplanes and pilots and then use them in an attack on bomber groups in the air. But Adolf Hitler thought it would be better to attack them on the ground. And it's hard to say which one would have been more effective. I actually tend to agree with Galland, but I think no one could say what the more effective plan would have been. In the end, I think it was, nothing short of an actual miracle could have saved Germany at that point.
Well, that's interesting that you think that, because I was thinking, well, I agree with Hitler there. And you're sitting ducks on the ground. You can take out more of them than waiting till they're in the air. They're all concentrated in that one airfield. Let's go and take that out. So it's interesting that you would have done it the other way around. The firebombing that went on, I mean, this horrific firebombing of the cities, we know about Dresden, there was also Nuremberg, there was just about every city was attacked in Germany. If people want to learn about that, they should check out revisionist.net, because it's got every city that they could find that was actually bombed, and the figures, the people, that the damage that was done. It's a fantastic website. We've talked about it before with the Eichmann diaries are on there, but there's also loads of other information about what happened during the war, what happened to the Germans after the war, how more Germans were actually killed after the war than during the war, all the expulsions, what happened to the Germans that were in parts that used to be German, like Prussia and parts of Poland and in Russia, all these Germans that had actually lived in these areas for hundreds of years, and then after the war they were all turfed out and ethnically cleansed. It has all that information in there, all the crimes of the Allies against Germany. It's a fantastic website. I really recommend that people go there and check it out. It's called revisionist.net, and it's run by Simon Shepherd from heretical.com. It was just last week was the anniversary of Dresden. So I mean, you're talking about this time of year when this was happening then, Schmidt, when Baer was making that daring run on the airfield.
Yes, and quickly returning to the two plans, I definitely see the merits of both of these plans. I think it's just in the air. You knew what you had to expect. This was well known. They will send hundreds of bombers escorted by hundreds of fighters. And when you attack the air bases, there are several factors that are unknown. You don't know whether the enemy fighters will be lying in wait. Will they have picked up by radar the approaching German fighters? How strong will the flak be? Because intelligence was not really good on the German side. But as I said before, it's really difficult to say what would have been the better solution.
I think another thing we forget was, you know, they didn't have radar then either, did they? They must have just been able to see with what they could see through the windscreen. Is that right?
No, they did have radar available at that time. It was just not as sophisticated as we think of radar as today. So basically, if you flew low enough, which is still partly true today, if you fly low enough, it's very hard for radar to pick up an airplane. And so they did that. They flew as low as they dared, because there was also fog on the ground level.
Yeah, I should imagine the weather played a large part in it. What the weather was going to be doing, what direction the wind was in, that would probably played a large part of their plans. Very different to today. Everything is computerized, and I guess there really probably isn't that much for a pilot to do when he's actually in the air. But back then, everything had to be, your brain had to be making all these computations every split second to be thinking what you're doing, keeping the altitude, keeping the direction going, thinking about when you're dropping the bombs or whatever. You'd have to be calculating exactly where they were going to hit with the speed that you were actually going at. And it's quite phenomenal intelligence, I would have thought, to actually be one of these pilots, not just quick reactions, not just quick reflexes, but very quick mentally at going through all the processes needed to ensure that you were going to have a successful run and you were going to come back safe. Do you know what the average life expectancy was with these pilots? How many sorties was the average that they would get to run before they would end up losing their lives?
I haven't looked into that, but I would guess that at the beginning of the war, the life expectancy was much, much higher than towards the very end of the war, because let's say from 1944 on, pilots didn't even have enough time to train, because so many were killed in action, and they just didn't have the time to thoroughly train the pilots anymore.
I should imagine that once they'd done sort of five or six runs, if they managed to do that without getting hit, then they would have picked up the hang of it. I should imagine most deaths occurred in the first first few sorties that they actually flew. If you think right back at the beginning of the war, most of these pilots had only had experience in gliders, hadn't they?
Yes, that's true. And, I just wanted to mention these terror bombings again, because I remembered reading about an eyewitness report of someone on the ground that witnessed what happened to these people getting burned alive. And I think that was probably the most demoralizing and horrifying report I've ever read. I think we cannot even begin to imagine what it was like for the people living in Dresden and the other cities.
And you think of other people that had to clear that up, and the bombing of cities. It was just like a gentleman's agreement that wouldn't take place. If we went to war, we weren't going to bomb each other's cities. And then Churchill went and did that, and he went and bombed the German cities. And the point of him doing that is because Hitler hadn't bombed any of the British ones, and he was desperate to get Hitler to bomb the British cities so that he had some justification for his war. Because up to that point, the people in Britain were saying, why are we going to war against Germany? Why are we going to war against Germany? And Churchill was saying, well, he's going to bomb Britain. He's going to attack Britain. And Hitler didn't attack Britain. So what Churchill did, he went over and attacked the cities and the civilians and bombed them. And I think it went on for two or three weeks before Hitler finally had enough of it and said, well, we're going to, you know, pay tit for tat. We're going to go back over to Britain and we're going to start bombing the British cities now. And again, this, you can learn more about this from a David Irving speech that he gave at the London Forum, which is about the British Bomber Command and when this first started happening, and all about why the terror bombing took place, and what was the cause of it, and how Churchill, when he knew that the German bombers were coming, he wasn't even in London. He gave the impression to the British people that he was in London in an air raid shelter somewhere, but he wasn't. He was away and out of London, and he knew that the Germans were coming over to bomb the city, and he left, and the British people weren't warned about it, because Churchill wanted that to happen. He wanted it to happen so that he had an excuse for his war, because it was all Churchill's war. None of it was what Hitler wanted. The last thing Hitler wanted was war. You only have to read Mein Kampf to learn that, which is, of course, why they don't want people reading Mein Kampf. It's interesting that now that it's been released in Germany again, it's top of the booksellers, top-selling book in Germany, and that's even with all the annotations. There are more annotations to the Mein Kampf book in Germany than there is actual text, which is all these Jews trying to say, oh no, this isn't right, and that isn't right, and this is what he really meant, he didn't really mean this. And yet it's still the best-selling book in Germany. And I think it was in Italy recently as well, school children voted it the best book in their top 10. School children.
Yes, I remember that.
Still incredibly popular, even now, so, you know, 70 years, 80 years later, and it's still a really influential book, probably the second most influential book to the Bible. And yet we don't have a really accurate British translation of it. The translations that we have, they're all lacking somewhat. None of them were proper official translations that were made from German into English. At least you get to read it actually in the original German, Schmidt.
Yes, that is true. And everything you said about Churchill wanting to provoke Germany into bombing British cities, this is all very well established. And actually, in the circle of people who research this stuff, this is not contested. But the sad thing is that most people have no idea about this. Their impression is that Hitler sent from the beginning sent all these bombers to have this blitz on London, and this is simply not true. In the beginning, he gave strict orders only to attack military targets.
And was it? And eventually, I mean, this is what we hear about in Britain. We hear, oh, the Blitz in London and Hitler bombed Coventry. But the British people don't know anything about what happened to Germany. You look at what's being done in Syria, and people are absolutely shocked when they see the damage that was done to Aleppo. But hundreds of times that amount of damage was done to Germany. When you see the pictures of what was done to these beautiful old cities that have been standing for centuries, these old buildings, these old statues, all just completely torched. And that firebombing, just bodies melting. And then the poor people that would have to go out and clean all that up the next day. You imagine what that must do to the psyche of the nation, seeing that happen to them. And then at the end of the war, the Germans have never been able to come to terms with this, with what they've seen, because they've been told that they committed this terrible atrocity against the Jews. They've been told that it was them that committed a terrible atrocity, when the truth of it was that they suffered the worst, possibly the worst atrocity that we have in history was done to Germany. And yet the German people have never been able to come to terms with that. They've never been able to talk about that. Instead, they have to talk about this terrible thing, imaginary thing, that they did to the Jews. I mean, it's such an injustice, isn't it, Schmidt? A real injustice that once you learn about it, it makes you really angry. Now, this is why they want to keep a lid on it. Instead of thinking, well, isn't it good all these Jews weren't actually killed? They know that people will put two and two together and think, well, hang on. The victim here is the one that's been made out to be the aggressor. It's shocking when you think about it. I'm just pleased that so many people are now waking up to it. Obviously, Dennis's films have really helped with that. You think how many people have watched Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told. There must be a million people that have watched it by now. Must be a million people. And I dare say a good half of them never had any idea of the truth behind World War II. He's woken up so many people and done so much good for Germans and for the white race. I mean, Dennis is a real hero for doing that, I think.
Yes, who could disagree with that? And I would have thought actually it could be several millions by now, but we will never know, I guess. Because YouTube shuts down his channel and all the views get erased, and then we don't know exactly about the other uploads to other sites. I don't know, have you ever asked Dennis how many people have viewed it on his website, on his own website?
I don't know on his own website. I know that it's gone well over a million. It went over a million at YouTube. So it must be two or three times that, the amount of times it's been uploaded to YouTube and to other sites.